to a brand new episode of Sacred Cinema here on 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. It's great to be back in 2024, and this week's episode is entitled Salvation by Sedation. Enjoyable holiday and New Year's festive season. I sure did myself. And we're getting things kicked off in 2024 with this episode entitled Salvation by Sedation. And we're looking at the interplay that we see in the three films we're going to talk about, the interplay between what you might call like a very dangerous situation or a kind of hellish or horrific or kind of scary situation a person might find themselves in, and the interplay between that situation and a person's ability to sort of sedate themselves or to sedate someone else, maybe to soften that reality that they find themselves in, that dangerous reality they find themselves in, kind of take the grit out of things, maybe filter out the scary thing or the difficult thing to face, to sort of censor it, you might say, perhaps for people that might be traumatized by it, who are looking onwards, someone they care about, for example, or even themselves, to avoid, you know, the scary situation that they found themselves in. And I guess when we're talking about this episode, I think it's a kind of topical thing, or it's something that definitely comes up a lot in life, that there's a lot of things around the world and in our lives that we find to be pretty concerning, that we don't really like to face up to, all sorts of political issues that happen, things that we've done in our own lives, things that have happened throughout history and the ripple effects that they have. And throughout history, people have dealt with some pretty crazy things like world wars and all sorts of things like that. And we do seem to have, every culture sort of has a mechanism for keeping us calm and making sure that we don't do it, that we sort of counsel ourselves or use therapy or some kind of means to avoid facing the sheer horrors that existence can throw at us. So we see it in a great deal of things, from movie ratings to trigger warnings to propaganda to state censorship. Even if you go onto social media, there's all sorts of filters that keep you from seeing material that might be a little bit graphic and that sort of thing. So it's certainly something that's everywhere that you look a little bit. And I think when we're looking at the characters in this week's film, I like to say this quite a lot, but we've maybe sort of peeled away from this a little bit. But I think it's really important when we talk about the characters this week and the films we're talking about, I think it's really important that we kind of see ourselves in all of the characters that are depicted. Some of the characters might be children, some of the characters might be prisoners. I think it's important that we see that these specific characters, that what they represent is different aspects of a single person. They represent different aspects of us. In other words, if we see an imprisoned character, that's representative also of the imprisoned self, or if we see a child in one of these films, that's a representation of the sort of the childish self or the vulnerable self or the innocent self, let's say. So it's not to sort of not see ourselves in these characters, because I think it is a very universal experience, and we're all certainly capable and we all do this sort of thing. But what are the films themselves? Well, the first film we're going to talk about is Roberto Benigni's 1997 film Life is Beautiful. We're then going to move on to Martin Scorsese's 2010 film Shutter Island. And then we're going to finish off with a new film, or from 2023, I should say, on Netflix called called Leave the World Behind, directed by Sam Esmail. But let's get started now with Life is Beautiful from 1997, directed by Roberto Benigni, which is a great surname to say. So it's a pretty famous film, this one. Benigni won an Oscar for this one very famously. His reaction was very theatrical, jumping up on the chair there. But if you're not aware of this film, it's a pretty simple film, not a particularly long film either. It's about an Italian gentleman who marries a lovely young woman in this beautiful Italian city in the 30s. In Italy, and they have a child, and then because he's of Jewish ancestry, he's taken away off to a concentration camp with his little boy. His wife follows as well to sort of keep the family together. And in essence, I guess the sort of the shtick of this film, or the general gist of it, is that because he's quite a sort of a chaplain-esque character, the protagonist, his name's Guido, he sort of dampens the whole, so he sort of puts a filter on what's going on for his little boy to sort of keep him away from being traumatized by the horrors of the Holocaust, and basically has a sort of a Chaplin-esque, I guess you could say, or like a real sort of physical comedy kind of Michael Richards kind of approach to living in a concentration camp and dealing with everything that's going on. And we sort of see in the sort of the run-up of this film how he is a bit of a sort of a trickster, a bit of a prankster, and he's sort of good at moving dishes around and put like a bit of a magician in a lot of ways. And so it's very entertaining to watch, and it's a very touching film because we see, you know, it being sort of a real beautiful sort of father-son film. Now, I guess unlike in its most basic sort of fundamental sense, it's a film that really, I think, depicts the human instinct, and we certainly feel this when we connect with the character, with the film, the human instinct to sort of protect the vulnerable from the immediate horrors of reality. And if you imagine, and why I guess why we find the film so touching is if you imagine that you are a parent with a child in a concentration camp, the last thing you'd want is for your child to be traumatized by that situation. We see it as quite a beautiful thing that he's able to do that. It's quite a feat. And we see him as a bit of a hero that he's able to keep his little boy, his cute little son, from being harmed by, again, another cute Italian kid. You know, Cinema Paradiso, The Bicycle Thieves. There's so many cute Italian kids in cinema. Anyway, moving on. I don't think not a particularly original point, but I think also that it's not only in the story that this is depicted, this idea of sort of protecting people from the immediate horrors of reality, particularly the vulnerable, but anyone really, I guess, in the case of the Holocaust. But the film does this itself. So because it's this kind of comedic and sentimental depiction of the Holocaust, and I guess you could say something similar about maybe something like The Sound of Music does this as well, we can watch this touching and seemingly realistic story of a father's sacrificial love for his son, whatever that sort of beautiful dynamic is that we love about this film. And it can do that in relatable terms and using real historical events, i.e. the Holocaust and the Second World War. These are things that actually happen, sort of fantasy film. So it's using vocabulary from history that we know and can connect with. But it's doing it in this very sentimental way and comedic way, so that we can connect with the events of the film and understand where we are, get some kind of bearing of what's happening in the background of this film. But we don't actually have to witness the true horror of those historic events, what were actually horrible historic events. Like if you watch a movie like Come and See or the first scene of Saving Private Ryan, it's a very different film to Life is Beautiful, but they're both about the same thing. And so us as the audience is also sedated. We're also looking at these events through a filter because it makes our movie enjoying, it makes us enjoy the film a little bit better. And I think this is probably best seen in the most sort of the tragic climactic scene of the film. If you've seen the film, I'm not going to give it away. But the way that that's done, the way that things are covered up, the way that the horror of that moment is concealed, literally concealed from the audience, if you remember what happens in the film, I think that depicts that point quite well, that not only the little boy is being sort of sedated from having to, you know, endure the horrors of this, but we as the audience are as well. But how realistic is this dynamic? Is it always the case that the protector sort of faces the true reality of the situation and shields the innocent, and that's the only sort of way that horrors are experienced by human beings? Well, before we get into our next film, just to remind you, while listening to Sacred Cinema, hosted by me, Jimmy Bernasconi, here on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. And please stay tuned for more Quality Radio programs here on 2XX if you're listening live, or jump onto our website to listen there and consider subscribing to the station or sponsoring the show while you're there. You'd be saving me if you could do that. So moving on out to the second film for today, and this would be Martin Scorsese's 2010 film Shutter Island. This one stars Leo DiCaprio and Mark Ruffalo, and they go to this island off the coast of Boston. Ben Kingsley's like the main psychiatrist there, and apparently some woman has escaped from this psychiatric facility, and these two US federal marshals, played by DiCaprio and Ruffalo, are there to figure out what's going on. Now, because it's a psychiatric hospital, there's a lot of, you know, people with sort of delusions and that sort of thing, and it's certainly a question. And you know, obviously we've got the setting of, like, just in terms of sort of obvious metaphorical elements at the beginning, you know, it's an island and it's a psychiatric facility, so in like a kind of, and it's kind of got a like a prison vibe to it, and they kind of throw that word around, calling them inmates or calling them prisoners and getting corrected for calling them patients and blah blah blah. So from on a very basic interpretation, I think the film is, it's a film about how the human condition is that of a person trapped in this sort of physically trapped in a sort of state of affairs where reality is always subject to self-doubt, where we're an alternative universe where we know everything, we understand our reality is far away past stormy seas, and we're kind of trapped in this fixed place, contained in this fixed place where we never really know what's going on and where who can we trust and whether we can even trust ourselves. So it's very much akin to, you can see the film is very much you're playing off films like The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which we've talked on the show. I also think like any sort of film that sort of talks about simulations and understanding, you know, where someone is, and you know, there's a lot of, it's interesting that it's got DiCaprio on it, there's a lot of connections with Inception as well. There's questions around dreams and dreamscapes and that sort of thing, and dreams within dreams and simulations within simulations, that sort of thing. But I want to kind of focus this week sort of on how it differs to something like Life is Beautiful, which is a film about how we can sort of sedate others for their own protection, and talk about how this is a film that it's not really about deluding others for their own good as much as it's about why one might delude themselves to avoid the horrors of their past, to avoid accountability and acknowledging their past wrongdoings, let's say. In short, why someone might want to sort of sedate or delude themselves to escape themselves or to escape their past self. And we, of course, we see this pretty early on in the film and throughout. And I know this is a film that people often, you know, give away spoilers with. And if you haven't seen the film, I really think it's a truly brilliant film, so I don't want to give away the spoilers of it. But we see this in a lot of the characters because they're in this hospital because they've done bad things. And so they kind of make up stories in their head about who they are, and they might change their names and things like that, and come up with these alter egos about, you know, what their situation actually is compared to, who they actually are compared to who they actually are. But I think that it's so much more than just characters or these characters coming up with alternative situations that they find. It's more than them just being deluded in a kind of two-dimensional kind of blanket way of, you know, just coming up with some kind of fantasy to break free of what one's past wrongdoings. What we actually see, I think, is that, you know, it's kind of like, it's not simply that we delude ourselves while the rest of the world kind of watches on. Right, and then they see us kind of go bling, 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 in the corner, and they go, well, look at that person, they're deluded. And they have this full understanding of how and why we're doing this, although some of the characters might get an idea that they fully understand what's going on. It's a little bit more complicated. It's not that we just delude ourselves and the rest of the world can understand and see that we're doing that, but we delude the world as well. So we delude the world, or we can delude the world, into believing that we've deluded ourselves. That's part of the trick. It's not just to delude oneself, because then people can just sort of say, oh, you're making up a lie for yourself and come here, we're going to put the chains around you. You've got to also trick the world into believing that you are genuinely deluded at the same time. And so it's almost like the ultimate way to avoid accountability, the ultimate way to escape from oneself and to avoid having to come to terms with the horrors of our past, is to convince the world that we are permanently incapable of doing such things, that that's never going to happen. We've got to sort of create a persona for ourselves, which is to say that I'm never going to become accountable. I'm not capable of that. That's not within my wheelhouse at any point in the future. And the beauty of that is that that invites control. So if we say that we're never going to be an active functioning member of society, we're completely deluded, we live in a fantasy land, it almost makes it incumbent upon the rest of the world, it almost invites them to step into our world, to step into our own sovereignty, let's say, and this is where sort of the elements of imprisonment sort of come into it, to say, no, please, we don't know any better, please make decisions for us, please treat me like I'm deluded, treat me like I'm a child, treat me like I can't make a decision for myself, so please make those for us. And you might think, when you think about this, like, well, why would anyone do that? But we do this all the time. We invite the hegemonic entities and institutions around us, and even sort of controlling and powerful people in our own immediate circles, to come in and take control of our lives all the time, because it means that we don't have to be the ones burdened with that accountability, and we can escape those parts of ourselves that we don't like about that. And I think we see this all the time. People play dumb all the time, or they play stupid, or they kind of play dead. And you kind of see this particularly with respect with at the risk of sounding a little bit like what's his name, the Smith fella, not Will, but his son. We very often play dumb, particularly with respect to sort of like the political and economic state of the world, right? We pretend that we don't know what's going on. We sort of rid ourselves of the guilt or rid ourselves of the accountability of actually doing something to fix it by playing dumb. Oh, I don't understand that issue. Oh, I don't understand how politics works. So you can't blame me for not doing it. And so we can sort of feel better and rid ourselves of the hard work that we kind of know we secretly need to do. We probably should read the newspaper, right? We probably should speak up if we see the world going down a bad path. But often it's the case that we don't, and we simply just give away aspects of our sovereignty, give away aspects of our decision making to other people to control us and control the world, because then we don't have to be the ones to do that. Now the tragedy of this, as you can probably tell, is that the systems of control then don't change, because if the controlled people find solace in that sedation and not having to do anything, if not having to come to terms with their own wrongdoing and not having to come to terms with their own liability, then they're happy. But also the controls are then enabled to continue to sedate, to continue to control. So there's simply no opposition to oppressive control or to hegemonic control in that situation, neither from inside or outside of the symbolic prison in that situation. And I think you can actually see this in the context of World War II itself and in the world of Life is Beautiful, where you see, I think, a very cynical way to watch a movie like Life is Beautiful. It's really about a man's guilt, about a citizen's guilt or a sense of guilt. Not that he should feel guilty, but I don't mean to victim blame in a sort of extremist sense, but the sort of sense of guilt he feels about the future of his country, particularly embodied in his son. And I think there's a way to read that film, and I think this would be very taking controls of the film to say this, but I think there is a way to read Life is Beautiful where the child kind of knows what's going on in the back of his head, but he goes along with it for the sake of his father. And so the delusion isn't actually the father deluding the son, but the son deluding the father by making him feel that he's being deluded by the father. And so this act that the father puts on is really ultimately for himself, so he can, he's ultimately internalizing the guilt and trauma that he's allowed this to happen to his family and allowed this to happen to his son. So this delusion is primarily for him, the delusion that his son isn't being horrified, even though the son probably at the back of his mind is aware that something terrible is going on. He feels better if his dad thinks that he doesn't know that something bad is happening, but all the while something bad is happening. No one is doing anything to fix it. But I think I've made the point clear there that it's not simply just, on one hand in Life is Beautiful, we have this concept of, people being geared towards protecting the vulnerable from the harshness of the world. We understand that, we can relate to that. But when we talk about Shutter Island and we look at Life is Beautiful sort of through that other lens, we kind of say, well, very often it's the case that we actually like to, despite wanting to protect the vulnerable, we also want to protect ourselves. We also want to protect ourselves from the horrors of the world, but the horrors of ourselves. And very often this is the case that we do want people to come in and accept and treat us as if we're deluded, even if we're not deluded. We kind of want people to think that we are, so that, if they can point to a bad thing we've ever done, we're like, well, I'm a deluded person. I'm not at the wheel. That's your responsibility. If I did something wrong, that was your fault. That's something you should have taken care of. There should have been another guardrail there. You should have parented me better. So we've got this interesting sort of conflict here between protecting others and protecting ourselves. And so who's this all for and how does this play out? Well, I think this third and final film we're going to talk about kind of reconciles some of these competing ideas. This is the new film Leave the World Behind, directed by Sam Esmail. And it's basically about this family that live in, a kind of fancy apartment in New York and go to an Airbnb out in Long Island. And they get a knock on the door that night, and it's Mahershala Ali and his daughter, who are the owners of the Airbnb, who are like, can we stay here? Because something's going on in the city. And as the film progresses, you find out that, the internet's down. There's been some kind of invasion from a foreign, technology hackers. And the America's essentially, subject to some kind of military invasion or some kind of military attack. And what I like about the film, at least in the context of today's conversation, I think it does sort of balance these two ideas together and kind of show us these two competing ideas we've talked about today together, and does kind of give us an idea of, like, in 2024 or in the 21st century, in this point we're in right now, how does this sort of mass delusion or this mass self-sedation, how does this play out in the real world? Well, we see from the beginning the sedation of the vulnerable, because we have this parent-child dynamic throughout the film, much like in Life is Beautiful, where Julia Roberts and Ethan Hawke and Mahershala Ali as the respective parents in this film are constantly sedating their children, where they let their children go on screens. You know, there's the line where Ethan Hawke literally says that his son could sleep through an atomic bomb, and he kind of plays that off like it's not a big deal. And I also like that there's a pool in the film, and the kids are always swimming in the pool, and I like that. I like that there's like a sort of, you know, like a motif of being underwater, being kind of like the fish that can't understand the land outside, like the world outside of it. Like, you know, when you go to swim, there's water goes in your ears, and you're kind of not always splashing around. You can't really see what's going on in the real world. You're kind of in an otherworldly kind of environment. But we also see on the outside of that, as much as there's that dynamic where the parents are trying to sedate the children, the parents are sedating themselves throughout the film. It's a very clear choice from Ismail to make sure that the parents are pretty much drunk the whole movie. And there's this whole thing about Ethan Hawke wanting to smoke, and you don't do any of the kids, but you can have smokers. I want you to sort of take the edge off, and there's a bit of marijuana use and that sort of thing. And then they go dancing. And we see constant use of vices throughout the film, ways for people to feel more comfortable. And the setting itself as well is very sort of comfortable, modern, rich, luxurious house as well. And I think there's also an element of, I can't help but think that there's a lot of sort of sexual, there's a bit of a sexual energy and a sexual dynamic to a lot of the characters. Particularly, there's this one like masturbation scene, which I think actually very much plays into this idea of like checking out from the world and kind of living in a sort of state of fantasy, and the sort of just, especially in the sort of digital age, about just sort of going back to like primal sort of the oppressiveness of sort of primal sexual urges, and sort of succumbing to that and not sort of, you know, doing that sort of thing, the privacy of your own dark bedroom, rather than going to the world and actually asking a girl out kind of thing. I think that very much plays into the idea of self-sedation and not accepting the world for what it is, and not enacting self-improvement, but just sort of sitting in one's own private dwelling and just doing that sort of thing on their own. And I think the rub of this is that no one is in control, right? Everyone is either sedating, is both sedating others and sedating themselves in this state of complete and total annihilation in the United States, which is, you know, famously the most powerful country in the world. And this idea of no one being in control is pretty on the nose in the film. It's like it's literally in the dialogue, and you do sort of see it in the plot. But I think you also sort of see it in the sort of, let's call it like the general characterization throughout the film, where this is a sort of complete lack of unity, both, you know, between the you know, Julia Roberts and Ethan Hawke's characters, and between the two separate families, and between all the different people, and then between all the people they come across. And if you've seen the film, you know what I'm talking about. There's a constant motif and constant dialogue about people not getting along and clashing and polarizing ideas and people hating people, and this kind of idea of misanthropy kind of underlines Julia Roberts' whole arc in this film. But I think the scariest part about this film, I think, and I very rarely read reviews of films before I chat about them on the show, just because I like to keep things fresh and original, but I could not help doing it for this one, just because I was so curious to know, because I only watched this film for the first time a couple of days ago for the purpose of this episode, and I'd already heard a little bit about it, and people kind of been quite frustrated with it. And it's so interesting that the film itself, despite being so concerned with the state of America's culture and society, the film itself, and get in touch with me if you feel this way about the film, because I'm very curious about it. It's being treated like it's pure entertainment, which is kind of, it's actually like premeditated in the film, because there's this line where Ethan Hawke's character, because he's like this professor at a university, he's talking about, he's like a media studies professor, and he talks about one of his students doing research into the idea that media is both an escape from reality, i.e. like a sedation, you know, like numbing oneself from the ills of society, but simultaneously also a reflection of society. And that's probably more what this film is. It's a political statement about the state of America right now and the state of America's culture. And when I went through the reviews that people have been making about this film, not from critics, but just from everyday people on like IMDb, so many people are treating this film not as if it's sociological commentary. They're just treating it like it's a film, like that with a beginning, middle and ending, and sort of saying, like, I was disappointed in this film, not because it had, like, poor social climate. Look, don't get me wrong, there are flaws to this film, flaws to any film, but there's flaws about the, you know, the dialogue's a bit stilted, and there's aspects of the, you know, it's a bit, I don't, like, necessarily think that it looks the way it should look, and there's all sorts of issues with the film, like, from a point of craft. But, like, in terms of its sociological stance, people just don't care. Like, they're not concerned with this pretty meaty subject matter that's pretty concerning. Like, the idea of there being a civil war in America or an invasion from another country is a very scary idea. The idea of an atomic bomb going off in New York City or, you know, anything. And then we're seeing there's a new Alex Garland film coming out about an American Civil War or something. Not the American Civil War, but like a future one. And just, if you, I do encourage people to go read the comments, and people are like, I didn't like the ending of this film because it didn't tell us all, it didn't explain what had happened properly. And like, should we not have a discussion about, like, the actual, what, like, forget the craft, like, what is the film, like, trying to induce in terms of conversation? If you don't agree with the, like, the political stance of the film, that's okay. Let's talk about that, and let's throw that question around. Like, maybe you don't think that America's as polarized as the film says, but I just can't believe how much people treat media as simply only an escape, simply only a sedation, simply only entertainment, and not an invitation to have a sociological, a conversation about society, a conversation about politics. So without, you know, with going too far down that rabbit hole, I think this week we've sort of established the idea that the world is a scary place, whether we want to accept it or not. And when we accept that it is scary, we kind of get this urge to make sure that that there's something virtuous, I guess, in sedating the vulnerable for having from seeing that sort of thing. It's not a nice thing to have your kid see, you know, the horrors of the Holocaust. But at the same time, it's not simply a question of, you know, there being strong people and weak people, and the strong protect the weak. The supposed strong people as well, you know, the adults, we all try and escape from reality all the time. We try and avoid our own accountability and liability, and even go as far as convincing the world and the powers that be to sedate us further, enact your control on me. I don't want to face who I am, I don't want to face what I've done, and I don't want to have to face the guilt that I might feel for having not done more with my life. And the result of this is that no one seems to be in control right now. It's like we're all spinning pretty recklessly in this kind of state of an uncertain world where no one's really sure of what's going on, and no one's accepting that no one knows what's going on. No one's wanting to fix that problem. It's like we're all these inflatable toys just randomly spinning around in a pool destined to collide. But perhaps there is some hope. And there's a scene in Leave the World Behind that I thought was really interesting. And in reading some of the reviews on IMDb about this, I did differ from how I think you're supposed to interpret the scene. But if you've seen the film, it's very important to the daughter in the film that she sees the finale for Friends. She's been watching Friends, you know, the Jennifer Aniston show. And this is sort of her means of sedation. And I think it's been interpreted that her, you know, as I kind of hinted at, her obsession with Friends is her means of sedation, you know, like how we all binge Netflix and things like that. And I want to talk specifically about the finale of Friends and the Ross and Rachel dynamic, this question of will they, won't they? I remember having a conversation with my own mother about that show when I watched it one time, and she was sort of talking about how much of a cliche it is, this sort of will they, won't. She was explaining what a cliche was, actually, and she used that as the example, I remember. And I was thinking about this idea of the will they or won't they thing being a cliche, and what is a cliche, and why do things recur over and over and over again in history? And I can't help but think that this concept of will they or won't they when it comes to, like, the geopolitical space or the broader political space, you know, will the North and the South be able to reconcile? Will America and its enemies be able to reconcile? You know, this question of will they, won't they on a global stage, I think we're kind of at that point right now. And the cliche is to say, in at least in the case of geopolitics, that it's going to end in a pretty bloody conflict. And I'm sure I'm not alone when I say that, you know, in there being that kind of will they, won't they aspect to it, we might be a little bit scared by that given what's at stake. But hopefully, if it is one of those situations, this is the one where we don't drift apart, but save each other instead. That's all we've got time for this week on Sacred Cinema. I've been your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, here on 2XX 90.3 FM. We'll see you again next week. Cheers.